he heard from Sunday and Eddie. For weeks he had been calling. Nothing. They had a Winnebago, and they used to travel a lot, so it wasn't unusual for them to be gone for stretches. He went over to their place to check on them, and the yard was overrun with weeds. He knocked and knocked. Nothing. He got spooked and called the police. He had a bad feeling. The police found two bodies inside, one male, one female. Approximately my dad's age, in their 80s. The lady was next to her walker in the living room. The man was in the bedroom. The description fit. Eddie and Sunday were dead. The police told my father we have to call the coroner and do an autopsy because of the rather odd circumstances and the length of time they were dead. My dad said fine, and he said he didn't want to see the bodies. The police told him to go to a coffee shop and come back in an hour. He called me. The next day, I picked up my dad and we drove to Woodland Hills. The bodies had been removed and the evidence gathered. My dad had somehow forgotten that he owned a set of keys, and he gave them to me and said he'd wait outside while I got the lay of the land. For a pugilist who saw plenty of blood in the ring, my dad was squeamish. I unlocked the door and tried to push it open, but it barely moved. Drifts of mail on the floor were blocking it. I shoved the door open enough to slide in, and right away there was the smell. Oh, the smell. Not only rancid and putrid, but chemical and toxic and sickly sweet like rotten fruit. A cocktail of decay. I held my breath as best I could. The room was pitch black. My eyes adjusted. Stacks and stacks and stacks of stuff. Stuff from QVC, stuff from yard sales, stuff from Christmases gone by. Clothing, furniture, stacks of newspapers, neatly wrapped in twine, piled almost to the ceiling. I knew from infrequent visits years ago that there was a sliding glass door at the other end of the living room. I had to get there and open it and let in some air and light. But how? It was an obstacle course of garbage. I passed by a walker and a large rectangular cutout of the carpet and padding where Sunday had been found. I hoped she hadn't suffered, but I saw the stain on the plywood subfloor, and I knew from my limited police studies that she probably had. A body doesn't secrete fluid other than urine if it's only dead a few days. Full body decay. She had been there a while. I saw two beat-up lazy boys with doilies on the arms. I saw a half-finished crossword puzzle on a soiled chair. I saw a nightstand in between the chairs with an electric clock radio blinking. Across from the chairs were three TVs stacked on top of each other. The broken sets on the bottom propped up the working one. I saw a gooseneck lamp on the nightstand, and I went over to turn it on. A tangle of extension cords all led to one dusty, overloaded power strip. With a little more light, I managed to make my way to the glass doors. Boxes fell. I pulled the drapes. They hadn't been touched in years. They were brittle. Eons of dust and dirt showered down on me. But no light came through the glass. A wall of cardboard covered it. I ripped the cardboard off. I was sweating now. My pulse raced. I needed air. I tried to open the glass door, but a wood dowel was in the track. I got the dowel out. The latch was jammed from years of disuse. I found a brass lamp and I used it as a hammer. Slowly the latch slid. Now there was a screen door caked with dirt, and as I tried to force it open, the dirt cascaded onto me and stuck to my sweat. I felt buried alive. I was wiping my eyes, panicking. At last, I busted down the screen door and stepped into the backyard. Close to passing out, I found a hose and poured water over my head and drank and drank and drank. It had taken me a half an hour to hack through this hoarder's maze, yet it couldn't have been more than 25 feet across. I went around to the front and got my dad and told him what to expect. He was aghast. He hadn't known. No one had. I imagine no other person except for maybe a pizza delivery man had peeked into the house in the last 20 years. We saw Eddie and Sunday on some holidays. They'd always say, "We'll meet you there. We'll meet you there." We never thought twice about it. My dad didn't want to go in, but we needed to know. Was there a will? Was there a safe deposit box? I described how hard it was to squeeze through the door, and my dad suggested we try getting in through the garage. It was so full of junk that they could just wedge in their car. I flashed on my mom's garage, full of old furniture and dusty, cracked dinnerware, and boxes of other people's discarded clothes. We shimmied alongside the car and went in. My dad retched. I told him to keep going. I wasn't doing this alone. In the kitchen, the fridge was half filled with decayed food, but mostly held condiments. The stove was dust-covered and stacked with papers and knickknacks. The oven was a storage locker for still more junk. Empty bottles of champagne were strewed about. The microwave was caked with food. I opened up the freezer, towers of frozen dinners. In the second bedroom, another cutout on the floor, half a man's length, probably about 4 feet long. Eddie. Oh, poor Eddie. Covering our mouths, my dad and I grabbed whatever papers we could easily find and loaded them up to examine later, elsewhere. They weren't ultimately the papers we needed, so we would have to return. Meanwhile, the autopsy results came back. Eddie and Sunday both had alcohol in their systems, prescription drugs, but nothing illicit, no foul play. Eddie died of blunt force. We were told he was found with one trouser leg on, one off. He was trying to put on his pants and fell and hit his head. Sunday, we guessed, was trying to get to him with her walker. She fell and broke her hip. Probably lay there for 3 or 4 days before she died. We finally found a will, handwritten. We were all mentioned, as was a guy named Dale with a Texas number. I called. "Who are you, Dale?" "I'm her son," he said. "Her son?" It turned out Sunday had a son from a previous relationship. Who knew? Certainly not my dad, or any friend or relative. Sunday was a devout Catholic. There must have been a scandal 70 years ago when she had been a teenager. She must have given the child up for adoption. Dale said, "How do I know you're being fair about this?" "Excuse me?" Dale continued, "How do I know you're dividing up the assets fairly?" "You're welcome to take over," I said. "I invite you to take over." He didn't, but to safeguard his interests, he called the county. Then they took over the estate and sold everything that was worth something, including the house, taking 5% as a fee. Before we learned the county would take over, we did a search to make sure we had found all the important papers. We found a box labeled "Empty Arrowhead Water Jugs." We opened it to find 4 empty Arrowhead water jugs, taped, closed, stored. Madness. My sister Amy found a paper bag neatly wrapped in twine. Attached to the twine was a label that read, "Two bras, too small." Amy pulled the neat bow off and opened it up. "Two bras Sunday must have outgrown. Truth in advertising." Robin found a box labeled, "Eddie's old underwear." Inside? Sure enough. Another bag was labeled, "Keys to the old cars." None of the keys fit the car in the garage or the abandoned vehicles parked in the dead grass in the backyard. So, they kept keys to cars they hadn't owned in years. All of this felt like the end point toward which all clutter leads, the end point to which all disordered thinking and living leads. And it struck me how sad their lives were at the end, how dark and chaotic, how devoid of reason. I spent weeks and weeks trying to put those images from my mind. And just when my own life seemed so good, so full of light. In a way, Sunday and Eddie had not only caused their deaths, they staged them. But why? I spent my life puzzling over human motivations, and I had trouble cracking this mystery. What is it that makes a person want to keep and curate garbage? Is it some kind of security blanket? Some hedge against time and loss? Some notion that the past might be resurrected through things? That those old cars might be driven again? My brother said it was mental illness. Dad said, "Nah, it's just nuts." stepson. My dad never had time to analyze the present, and the past was the past. He was all about the future, full steam ahead. He was a dreamer. You could say he hoarded dreams. But they all revolved around the same goal. He was going to be a star. Nothing short of stardom would do. Of all the side roads and jaunts and harebrained ideas, of all the distractions and detours, he probably had the most success with his magazine, Stars Homes. He would research and find the addresses of stars and take photos of their houses and publish them for tourists. Here's Jimmy Stewart's home. Here's Lucille Ball's mansion. Hey, look, it's Robin Williams' place. He'd list his own name and home in the magazine. Joe Cranston, Hollywood producer. Well, would you look at that? Joe, you have a place on the beach in Malibu. Sly grin. Why, sure. My dad actually lived in a condo in Studio City. He felt a blurb about his imaginary beachfront mansion would somehow give him credibility, and he also thought it was hilarious. Behind the laughter was the hard fact that he'd never have a Malibu address. When I was just getting my career going, I worked for him. The business was mostly mail order then. I went to the P.O. box in Hollywood and got the checks and cash out of the box. I stuffed the magazine in envelopes and mailed the envelopes to subscribers. And then the business evolved. Dad made his money at point of purchase, at all the places they sell Hollywood memorabilia, like the world-famous Grauman's Chinese Theater. The shops would take the magazine on consignment. They got a piece, he got a piece. At the end of the magazine's run, he still had the big names of yesteryear, but very few relevant stars of today. He needed to update his list, get more current stars, and that was beyond him. I was one of the few current actors pictured in Stars Homes. "Would you look at that, Brian?" he said. "You made the cut." He was trying, in his way, to help me. It wasn't so different from the way my Aunt Sunday clipped my name from the weeklies. My dad was proud. He was trying to show it. But I always felt there was a hidden agenda. He was continually trying to get me to promote and produce his screenplays. He'd hold up a script. "Do you think you can get this to Tom Hanks?" At 25, as soon as I was steadily employed on Loving, I started loaning him money. Small, manageable sums to start. Then we graduated to larger sums. I covered his utilities and his rent on occasion. And then I paid the funeral expenses for his mother when she died. I'm sure Eddie loaned my dad money and never saw it again. Uncle Eddie wasn't rich, but he had a job. He worked as a gaffer in Hollywood for 30 years and made investments. He might have ended up a hoarder in the end, but he didn't squander what he had earned. My dad came to me fairly regularly, a few times every year. It felt like a role reversal, like he was my son asking his dad for a loan. I didn't cherish the feeling, but I couldn't spend my time being angry. He didn't much like it either, but he was often desperate. He was often the recipient of pink-hued caution bills from the gas company or departments of water and power. He was always on the verge of losing service. I came to accept that he relied on me financially, but that I couldn't rely on him emotionally. One day he asked to see me, something very pressing. I sighed, knowing that the in-person request always meant a big check. Sure enough, he asked to borrow $30,000. "$30,000?" I said. "Wow. Why do you need $30,000? "I can't tell you." "We're not going to play this game, Dad." He hesitated. "Cindy is sick," he said. "But you can't tell her I told you." Cindy was my dad's wife of 35 years, the woman he left my mother for, the woman he stole from the husband he'd knocked out cold in the courthouse corridor when I was a boy. In spite of their rocky beginning, Cindy and my dad were actually well-suited. I'd gotten along fine with them ever since she and my dad quit drinking. At my wedding, Robin moved to give my father a hug, and Cindy, already seriously drunk at our afternoon ceremony, said, "Get your hands off my husband." I took my dad aside and I said, "She stops drinking and you stop drinking, or I'll never see you again." I meant it. He knew I meant it. And that was it. They stopped. And they both became born-again Christians. Now, Cindy was facing cancer. Two kinds of terminal cancer, in fact. She didn't want chemo. She wanted to cure herself naturally, and she found some doctor in Mexico who had promised recovery to patients by cleaning the blood. Robin and I checked out the website. Very shady looking. The process was illegal in the United States, so the doctor had set up an operation in Tijuana. I talked to a board-certified oncologist who told me that there was no hope. One of those conditions was a death sentence. Two? With 100% certainty, she had a maximum of a year to live. But my father begged, "It's going to save her life." He was desperate. Robin and I discussed the matter, and we agreed. We knew this transfusion wasn't going to save her life, and yet Cindy and my dad believed it. I said to Robin, "You know what this is? This is a $30,000 get well soon card." We gave my dad and Cindy the money, and they were extremely grateful and ventured into her treatment with hope. Cindy died the following May, almost exactly 1 year after her diagnosis. Son. The whole family was at a Japanese restaurant celebrating Taylor's high school graduation. My brother was out from New York with his girlfriend Greta. After we had returned from our motorcycle trip in 1978, Kyle had gotten a theater degree from UCLA, but he didn't give the acting life long before he moved to New York to live in an ashram. He now buys and sells college textbooks and lives happily on Long Island with Greta, an actor as well as a hairdresser. In 2011, Kyle was visiting me on the set of Breaking Bad. Greta was there, too, visiting her brother Stephen Michael Quezada, who ably played Steve Gomez, Hank's solid DEA partner. I think that was the first time on the set for both of them. Kyle and Greta basically took one look at each other, and whoosh, they were in love. Both Kyle and Greta are talented actors and wanted to get back into the business, but they needed a reel to showcase their work, a project to get things going. A flash went off. With the newer cameras, we can make a movie so much more cheaply than in the Last Chance days. Now, on Taylor's big night, I turned to my dad and said, "What if you wrote an 80 to 90 page script? Something contained, not big in scope. Something we could get done. I'll put up the money, $30,000-$40,000. We can get a fresh out of film school director, someone talented and eager and hungry. We'll put together a crew of people I know, and Kyle and Greta will both have good roles in it. Let's make a movie together. What do you think?" Odds are the film wouldn't be a box office success or even break even. I knew I'd probably never see that money again, but it wasn't about that. It was about the experience, working together as father and sons, and Greta. A personal success, something we could be proud of, something that would bring us closer. I was excited. My dad smiled wryly and said, "No." No thinking or mulling, just no. He had zero interest in such a puny passion project. He only wanted the Holy Grail. He mentioned one of the scripts he had been working on, a project that would require around $15 million to produce. "I'm going to get that made." "But we can do this now," I said, "while you're working to finance your other one." Again, he politely declined. My dad was only interested in the home run. Early in my career, I learned how to hit singles. He spent his whole life swinging for the fences. Until I knew I could hit a single, I didn't go for moonshots. No matter how many times I butted up against the hard fact of who my father was and wasn't, it always hurt. There's so much dark territory between fathers and sons. My dad and I could never bridge that distance. We never reached each other. We never met. I was shooting Trumbo in New Orleans in the fall of 2014, and I talked to my dad on the phone. He had a pacemaker put in the previous Saturday, and his voice sounded weak. He was now 90, but that was the frailest I'd ever heard his voice. That was the last time I would talk to him. Robin called me before dawn the next morning to deliver the news. Months later, we were at my dad's condo, packing up his belongings, and my daughter, Taylor, found a scrap of paper. It was dated just 3 days before he died. In his shaky handwriting, it read, "The highlight of my life was when my children forgave me." I'm glad he knew. He had blown such a hole in our lives when we were kids, and I'd never truly understood why. But I didn't need to grasp it intellectually, and I had forgiven him. I had let it go. Sibling. After Dad was gone, my sister Amy suggested that the three of us siblings go into therapy. I see a therapist from time to time when I'm feeling edgy or anxious, and Robin and I have been going to couples therapy periodically. We have an agreement. If either of us feels like going, the other can't object. I suggested this system to her before we were even married, and it's worked for us over the years. So I said yes to Amy. Sure, why not? Kyle was in, too. We hired Robin's therapist, female, and mine, male, to be in the room with the three of us, the Cranston kids. We talked for a while, and then the therapist gave us their sense of things. "This is quite normal," they said. "Pretty bad childhood. Not as bad as some, worse than others. You each found a way to survive. You each found a way to cope. That's perfectly understandable, perfectly acceptable, perfectly right at the time. The problem is, those same coping mechanisms that you use to survive a less-than-perfect childhood will cannibalize your life as an adult and prevent you from growing to your full potential." "Amy," they assessed, "you came into the family when things were starting to go south. You never got proper love and nurturing. Your veneer is you're perfectly fine without love. You adapted and you learned to do without it." My sister, Amy, is 6 years younger than I am. She was 5 when my dad left. So no stringing lights for Christmas, no homemade Halloween costumes, none of the good stuff. She only knew my mom lonely and drunk and consorting with relatively unambitious, trying to get by with the least amount of responsibility men. Amy had zero guidance, zero assistance or support in seeking an education. She left high school at 16 and got her GED. Then she moved out on her own and began to support herself, taking college classes at night. Amy became a licensed vocational nurse and then went on to get her bachelor's degree. Next was her master's in education. Now she's the administrator in a school system with a doctorate in education. Given her history, she looked destined to struggle, and now she has a doctorate. I really don't know how she did it. She's a miracle. But when the therapist assessed her, she recognized herself immediately. "Yep," she said, "yep, yep, that's me." "Brian," they said, "you take your pain and you divert it. Instead of working through it, you deflect it. You use humor when you get embarrassed or vulnerable. You use performance to exercise the demons. You use acting to sort through your emotional baggage. You get love from your work. It's therapeutic for you, cathartic." "Yep, you're right," I said. "It's true that I use humor to deflect, and it's true that in acting there's safety and vulnerability. It's the character crying, not Brian. I found a channel, a use, for the anger and resentment and feelings of abandonment that came from my childhood. I flushed those feelings through my system and into my work. Is that always enough? No. I check in with my therapist when I hit a rough patch. I go for a run when I need a release. I found multiple ways to cope, but acting has been my great salvation." "Now, Kyle," they said, "you're still holding it, brother. You think it's your fault. You're still feeling it." "Yep," Amy and I said. But Kyle looked at us quizzically. He couldn't see it. He was still inside of it. I thought of the 90th birthday party we had thrown for our father just a few months before he died. Amy didn't make any remarks because she didn't really know my dad. I said something jokey, like a pretend eulogy, diverting my feelings, true to form. Then Kyle got up and did this whole elaborate tribute. He put a lot of time and effort into it. If you had been in the audience and didn't know our history, you'd say, "How lucky were these three kids to have a dad like that?" Amy and Robin and I were looking at each other and wondering, who is Kyle talking about? In my dad's later years, Kyle talked to him every day. To the end, he was the dutiful son, attempting to mend the damage that years of absence had wrought. At times it seemed to Amy and me that Kyle was trying to reinvent a perfect father-son relationship. My brother is a sensitive, thoughtful, compassionate, and hardworking man. He was generous and faithful to the relationship with my father. He wanted to make it work. I said to Kyle at one point, "I don't think Dad is capable. He's already done all he can do. Think about the movie we offered him, a chance to work with his sons in his chosen field. He was not willing to make it, even to discuss it." But Kyle had his own truth, his own memory. My brother is 2.5 years older than me. In our early lives, our experiences were very close. I think of our McNulty Avenue garage productions. I think of how we supported each other as we stocked other people's junk and odds and ends to sell. How we clutched each other as our dad went out to beat the man who cut him off in traffic. How together we were jolted out of our lives and into the country, charged with killing chickens. I think of the epic motorcycle trip, those days we spent riding with no plan, no sense of obligation. The future and the road endlessly open in front of us. We were as close as brothers could be, but there were underlying differences, always. Kyle knew our dad longer while our family was still intact. He knew 2.5 years more of the happy times, and the happy times seared into him. So Kyle, who was always the most emotional of the three of us, who always felt things more deeply, felt them longer, he felt the blow of the loss of those happy times the most. I always thought of my brother as being at the bow of a ship, getting battered, getting the brunt of the storm, and I was in the boat behind him. I had Kyle to guide me and show me the way through. He did things first, and I watched him, and then I did them. That's how I learned. In so many ways, my brother is my savior. I love him, and I owe him a great deal for how my life turned out. Dad. Robin and I felt that the best thing we could do for our daughter was to let her figure things out, and even get into trouble now and then, so long as she always knew we would be there. When something moderately bad happened to my daughter, outwardly I was saying, "Oh, honey, I'm so sorry." Inwardly, I was shouting, "Yes." You've got to fail, or risk failure, to learn, to succeed. You've got to be hungry. It seems to me the job for parents is to console the failure, but nurture the hunger. That's how you create independence in children. Give them the tools they need to be functioning adults. Our goal, Robin's and mine, wasn't to raise a well-adjusted child. It was to raise a well-adjusted adult. And she's become just that. Taylor is an actor, and thank God she's good. And she's refining her craft daily. She just received a major break in her young career, a co-lead role in a TV series. Her modesty and desire for privacy stops me from boasting further. Taylor is fully aware that this is just one job, albeit a good one on a well-written show, and no one can predict its success. Her work ethic and sensibility fill me with pride. After she learned she got the part, she kept her survival job up to the last minute. That's my girl. We talk often about acting and storytelling, but we rarely talk about each other's work. My number one role is to be her father, not her acting coach. All I want to do is support her passion. When we discuss acting, it's usually about someone else's work, a play's merits. But I suppose some of what I've tried to share with my daughter about life has applications in acting. I've always encouraged Taylor to wander, to feel it's okay not to know exactly where you are. Figuring it out builds confidence. Of course, I don't want her to be risky to the point of being dangerous, but go ahead, get lost. It's okay to be afraid. Being afraid can actually be a sign you're doing something worthwhile. If I'm considering a role and it makes me nervous, but I can't stop thinking about it, that's often a good indication I'm onto something important. Fatherhood has been such a part, and it's been my favorite one. LBJ. I needed to let Walter White die, and I thought the perfect way might be a different medium, a play. I asked my agents at UTA's New York office to look out for something great, and I got a call right away. I found it, Brian. The character is on par with Walter White, only on stage. But it's different. It's like King Lear. The 36th President of the United States, Lyndon Baines Johnson, in a play called All the Way. Huge role, huge risk. The play would run nearly 3 hours, and I'd barely have the chance to take a breath. I'd be off stage for about 15 minutes total, and the character, the man, was big. LBJ was brilliant, and cruel, and restless, and funny, and visionary, and angry, and ambitious, and insecure, and much more. It could be a tour de force if done right, or it could be a big dud. Professor Flipnoodle on a national stage. I read it through, and one scene toward the end of the play stuck with me for days. Johnson is getting ready for bed, and he laments, "I have a genuine desire to unite people, but my own people in the South are against me, and the North is against me, and the Negroes are against me, and the press sure doesn't have any affection for me. I could drop dead tomorrow, and there wouldn't be 10 people who'd shed a tear." His assistant tries to comfort him. "That's not true, Mr. President." "The hell it ain't," Johnson snaps. "People turn on you so fast. When my daddy lost everything, people who had been glad-handing him treated him like dog shit, humiliated him to his face in public. And my mother, the way she would freeze him out, that's what killed him. You know what I think it is? People think I want great power, but what I want is great solace, a little love. That's all I want." He was reliving his pain, his father's embarrassment, his mother's cold demeanor. I could imagine it. I could see myself on stage, allowing myself to sink in, letting the audience witness that moment, that pure vulnerability. I could see myself conjuring up that pain, the need. The neediness was at the root of everything LBJ did, everything he was, his quest for power, and his flaws, and his great gifts. I thought of my own ego-driven father, my broken-hearted mother. If I did this play, they'd be on stage with me, too. I could imagine tears coming to my eyes, and I could feel the energies and sympathies of the audience. I felt them crying, too. Then, after I gave the speech, I could imagine myself abruptly changing, embarrassed, almost slap myself to get rid of the tears. Fuck it. I'd try to cover. Pain is vulnerability for a man, especially a man of that generation. I'd give the audience a glimpse of Johnson's soul, how he truly felt, then slam the door. I imagined myself on my feet, close to the audience, so that I was able to talk very quietly, so quietly that they'd have to lean in. They'd want to lean in. They'd yearn to be close. And with a few words, I'd make them feel more alive. On stage, you and the audience, it's like sonar. You give them something, and it all washes back to you, especially with the right part. And what a part. That was the part. It was my part. I knew I wanted in, but I also wanted to meet the writer and director to make sure they wanted me, and to make sure we were a good fit. Bill Rausch, the director, and Robert Schenken, the playwright, came over to my house. The agency is fond of saying, "It's not an audition." But in truth, every meeting is an audition. I'm sure Bill and Robert wanted to see if I was in the ballpark of what they had in mind for LBJ. And in truth, I wanted to know, is this going to be a director who is rigid about everything I try? A writer who thinks every word is chiseled into stone? I don't work well with that kind of domineering, my way or the highway type of writer or director. I work better in collaborative environments. Everyone respects each other, challenges each other, and works toward a common goal. The best idea wins. As part of the storytelling complex, as an actor, I have to be able to know I can ask questions and be heard. I wanted to know if Robert and Bill would allow for that kind of exchange. In the protocol of theater, there's far more respect for the writer than there is in film and TV. A history of reverence and laws protect the text. You're not allowed to change lines without the playwright's permission. You can't even cut text unless authorized. No rewriting allowed. In film and TV, you respect the text, but it's a blueprint, not a Bible. Changes are common, especially when stars insist on them. In the theater, your director and your writer, if you have the luxury of a writer being present, if he or she is cooperative and not dead, are giving you notes through the previews. They change lines and blocking and make adjustments. But after opening night, you're in what they call a locked show. In my view, that is the antithesis of what creativity should be. As long as actors and audiences are showing up, nothing is locked. How can it be? With any play, moments can get bigger or smaller. They evolve from night to night. Sometimes I change for no other reason than just to see how it feels. I think of something. I twist the reading of a line. It may result in a bigger laugh. It may not. Then I try it another way the next night to see what happens. To me, it's not disrespectful. I'm part of the creative triumvirate. Writer, director, actor. I listen, I respect, but I don't lock anything. That works for computer programming, not acting. I think you run a tremendous risk of getting complacent if you don't keep looking for changes. You should never be too at ease on stage. Get too rehearsed, too relaxed. You lose focus and slip into autopilot, and then you're not listening. Someone could drop a line. You have to be able to work out that problem, react to it. He skipped ahead, so I need to clarify that point for the audience. Otherwise, they're completely lost. Whenever you're trying something new, it's scary. Some actors panic. Some don't. Some assimilate mistakes and correct course. Others can't. If you're paying attention, if you're present, more often than not, you can rise to the occasion. Or sometimes your castmate will rise to the occasion for you. I know I've been bailed out many times. But you can't bank on someone else coming to the rescue. You have to be open and present and willing to adapt. If you tell me a play is locked at opening night and there's no room for exploration or change, I'd say I'm probably not the best actor for your play. If every night you gesture here, put your hands on your hips there, if every night you sip your drink on exactly the same line, your consciousness will pop out of your body. You'll be a casual observer of yourself, going through the motions. Once that happens, you're dead. You're a robot. Every performance needs to have its intimacy, its difference. Every night, a new audience is sitting out there in the dark, waiting. And you're new, too. You're a day older. Maybe you're hoarse. You drink some hot tea. Then you're on stage and you may have to pee like a racehorse. Note to self, ease up on the tea. Maybe you didn't eat as much as you did last night. You're hungry. Use that. You caught a cold. You have a sinus infection. LBJ is dealing with the same maladies on stage, blowing his nose, hacking away. You bring everything you are on stage with you, and you see if it could fit into that character. If it doesn't, you need to take note of it and make an adjustment. Bill and Robert and I sat down for coffee in the guest house of my home in California. I wanted to know, were they open? Or were they locket people? Were they going to say the play is the play? We talked for a while, and then I suggested we read some passages. They were delighted. Since it wasn't an audition, it would have been awkward for them to ask me to read, but I'm sure they were wondering, can this guy pull it off? Together we found out. Robert picked out a scene. How about this one with Hubert Humphrey? I read, they listened. I experimented with putting LBJ's voice in my body, and suddenly I felt more attached to the role. At the end of the meeting, we all knew. They liked what I had done, and I liked them. They were not rigid, nor were they pushovers. I had a strong feeling we'd make a good team. And I could see myself in the part. This could work. We got the agents involved, signed a deal. We'd open in Boston in the late summer of 2013. I dove into the research. The literature on Johnson is wide and deep, and I got lost in it. I devoured Robert Caro's masterpieces. I listened to the LBJ tapes that Michael Beschloss edited and put into historical context. I read LBJ's memoir, The Vantage Point, as well as books by Doris Kearns Goodwin, Joseph Califano, Taylor Branch, and Mark Updegrove. I also visited the impressive LBJ Library in Austin, Texas, and soaked up everything I could. Lastly, and most importantly, I leaned on the brilliant, powerful text in front of me, Robert Schenken's All the Way. I arrived in Cambridge, where we'd be mounting the play at the American Repertory Theater before taking it to Broadway. We gathered for a table read of the play, and it was me, 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 him, me, 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 her. Oh my God. I'd read the play a few times before, but I'd been reading it objectively, not from a logistical, elbow grease, what's it gonna take perspective. I'd been looking for a deeper understanding of the story, the man, not thinking, look at all these lines I need to memorize. At the end of the reading, we got the schedule, 4 weeks. We had 4 weeks before our first audience. The first week, we'd rehearse Act One. The second week, Act Two. The third week, we'd put it all together. The fourth week would be a technical rehearsal. Costumes, lights, makeup, sound. That wouldn't really count as time for the actors to prepare. So basically, we had 3 weeks. Holy shit. What had I done? Or more appropriately, what had I not done? I thought that if I showed up in Boston with the character nailed, I'd be in good shape. But I got lost in the joy of the research and neglected the nuts and bolts work, memorization. It was as if I had been planning a feast, and then a few hours before serving it, I realized I hadn't shopped. The table was set, but the main thing was missing, the food. Usually, preparing for a part, I memorize alone, but I knew this time I'd need help. I contacted my old friend Bill Timoney. When I was on Loving, he was on All My Children, playing Alfred Vanderpool. We were on the same network, our studios right around the corner from each other in New York, and we became fast friends. Now, I hired Bill to come to Boston with me to be my right arm, to be my coach, to run lines with me, to help me with the daily stuff, power me through. He knew what that would entail, and I knew he knew. Bill is bright, personable, perceptive. I knew I could count on him. I'd never had problems with memorization before. Over the years, I developed a habit of doing margin work, writing notes to myself in the margins of the script. That helps me memorize or bone lines as well as developing the character. I write a sentence's verb in the margin, a trick I learned from Jane Kaczmarek, and the active verb works like a gatekeeper to the rest of the sentence's meaning. As I am familiarizing myself with a speech, I can test myself by just reading the list of verbs in the margin to trigger each sentence. Pretty soon, I've memorized a page, then repeat the process for the entire script. But this part was so big, and I had so little time. The amount of dialogue I had to memorize was mind-boggling. Too many verbs. Do the work, I told myself. Just do the work. There are no shortcuts for doing the work. But I soon started to feel like the amount of work I had to do would crush me. I've loved work and thrived on work my whole adult life, but I was just dizzy with how many words I needed to stuff into my brain. Within a week, I had serious doubts about whether I was going to be able to pull it off. My uncertainty affected everything I did. My mind was heavy, my chest was heavy. Even my legs felt heavy when I went for my run. Each day was so crammed with input that I thought the wiring in my brain might short-circuit. By night, the morning was a distant memory. Before bed, I'd call Robin. I don't know if I can do this, I told her. Sure you can, she said. I need more time. I thought, I have to be in a place where my body can support this effort, this stress. I tailored my whole existence around the role. I ate oatmeal and vegetables and white fish with a squeeze of lemon. No sugar, few carbs. I pounded water. Every meal, I sat with a script. Every night, homework. 7 days a week, I worked. I needed every minute. We had finished blocking the first act and were now on to Act Two. A couple days into that second week, I was feeling desperate and asked for a meeting with the writer and director. Off-site, I didn't want to talk in the theater, too close to home. I took them across the street to a park in Cambridge. "I'm drowning," I told them. "I'm dying here." They exchanged a curious look. "What are you talking about?" They said, "You're in great shape." "I don't feel that way. I don't have enough time to be ready." "No, no, you're on track. Keep going." Every day I willed myself out of bed. Sit-ups, push-ups, a run every other day. Oatmeal, and then into the play. I'd see how well I remembered what I did the day before, and then I'd go further. I'd memorize more. By 10 a.m., I was at the theater rehearsing. At dusk, I'd go outside with my script just to get some air. I'd eat dinner, then read more sections of the play. I'd go to sleep with the play on my chest and wake up with pages scattered all over my bed. Except for bike rides with Bill on Mondays and Breaking Bad on Sunday nights, that's all I did. The play, the play, the play. I stayed on it. The other actors would shoot the breeze, talking about their days off, dinners, day trips. "What about this new movie? Did anyone try that new restaurant?" I was envious and resentful of their freedom. For a minute. And then I went back to work. As we rehearsed, per equity rules, we took periodic 15-minute breaks. I'd get some oxygen and do a stretch, and then back to the play. Reading, rereading, making notes, memorizing. I was never without it. Even when I went for a run, I was working on how I would deliver a line, where I'd punch it up, when I'd hold back. The play was always with me. "I don't think I can do this," I said to Robin more and more urgently. We were nearing the end of the second week. "I'm adrift. I'm at sea." "You can do it," she said. She hadn't heard me like this, other than when I struggled through Brooklyn South. I was doubting, but I heard no quaver of doubt in her voice. Her counsel was soothing. She believed in me. "Trust the process," Bill Rausch said. "It's amazing what the brain will allow you to do. You open your brain and fill it with words, and you close it and let it rest. You have to rest. And then the next day you'll be able to stretch and fill it with more. I wouldn't say this if I didn't see it working every day. You have to trust the process." Bill was a wonderfully open and generous director, supportive and smart. I wanted to believe him. I understood intellectually, but it wasn't resonating. Easy for him to say. He wasn't going to be on stage forgetting lines. I nodded along, but I was steeped in doubt. By the end of the second week, I was feeling my sanity at risk. For the first time in my life, I was having that classic actor's nightmare. I was on stage doing the play, and then, blank. I couldn't remember my lines. I felt naked, defenseless. I gave pleading looks to my fellow actors, but they couldn't help. I was on my own. The audience was looking at me with sympathetic embarrassment. If I was lucky, I'd wake up from the awful dream before too long. But then I couldn't go back to sleep because there was too much adrenaline running through my system. Bad sleep? Good luck with the memorization tomorrow. I had had moments of insecurity and doubt before in my career, but never the standard anxiety dream, never the nightmare. Now I had had it a few times. It would shadow me through the morning hours. It was hard to shake. When I was feeling overwhelmed on my walk to work, I would concoct these elaborate victim scenarios, morbidly reassuring daydreams. What if I got hurt? What if I got injured just badly enough so that I couldn't do the play? Then it wouldn't be my fault. I couldn't be blamed if the play was delayed or canceled. I started imagining a Tonya Harding-type situation. Could I pay someone to kneecap me with a baseball bat, put me out of commission? Not a permanent injury, just enough to sideline me for a couple of weeks. No one would blame me if I had to bow out because of a shattered kneecap. And then it was out of the reverie and back to the play. Bill Timoney said to me, "Here's the bottom line. Come the first night of previews, you will be on that stage. You will perform. So work backward, Trust that you'll get there. Don't stop working. We won't stop working. We'll get you there. Yes, I just had to trust the people around me and the process and keep working. Never stop working. With 1 week to go, the play suddenly began to open up. It began to come to me. Everything I'd done in my life seemed to have prepared me for this moment. Collecting eggs and killing chickens at my grandfather's farm. Watching my mother gather junk to sell at swap meets. She didn't give up. Announcing that Abraham Lincoln was going to write one of America's greatest speeches as soon as he returned to the white front. That failure and embarrassment was with me somewhere, too. Opening night, I stood in the wings as the audience got settled. The play called for the other actors to fill the empty seats on stage, and then the lights to cut to black. That was my cue. Downstage center, right in front of the audience, that empty seat at center stage, that was my seat. 2 weeks earlier, it looked like an electric chair. Now, opening night, it looked like a throne. Standing in the hushed darkness, I smiled. Oh, that's why I went through this. The monastic life, the doubt, the work, the pain. It was all part of it. It was all so that I could have this feeling. It was so that I could live this moment. I took 3 deep breaths. I shook those breaths into my body. And then I relaxed. I let it go. And I went to take my place.
A Life in Parts was written and read by Bryan Cranston. It was recorded by Andrew Meisner at RRR Studios in Sherman Oaks, California, and Tucker Dalton at CDM Studios in New York. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. Open and close credits were mixed by Terry Hogan and Rick Bradley. The associate producers were Michael Noble and Taryn Ocko. A Life in Parts was directed by Elisa Shokoff and Travis Tun, and produced by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. A Life in Parts is available in print from Scribner.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.